Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Joy Scouts podcast. And today we're going to talk about data mining and learning. This is insane, the world that we live in. It's all about information. It's all about data. You and I, we're just human beings. We can listen to somebody talk on a podcast, and that's about all we can hear and about all we can process. And most of the time, you're not going to hear or process every single thing I do. What we see nowadays is data being processed and used at an extraordinary rate, much faster than any human being can individually do. This technology is the future. It's the present as well. And if you don't understand how data works, you're going to be exploited. But then we're going to find out why data isn't the full story. And that's going to tie us up by talking about the Challenger explosion. So welcome to today's Joy Scout podcast. All right. Data. Your data is being tracked. You are allowing it to happen by your own biases as well. People that use Facebook, that use social media, their data is being used by marketers, by advertisers, and by political campaigns. What we don't realize is that a lot of us are putting ourselves into what are known as emotional or informational ghettos. An informational ghetto is a small closed social network. You hear the same talking points repeated over and over, same political views. You're not challenged by your thoughts or viewpoints, and there's social pressure to conform. So these informational ghettos, it's when people, they stay on the same news outlet. People that only listen to Fox News or only listen to CNN, those are very biased news networks. People that stick to internet groups with very similar insulated mindsets and don't stray outside of that. And this is exacerbated by use of social media. People that don't actually go out of their way to talk to, engage with, or converse with people that they don't already agree with creates these informational ghettos. And it's dangerous because when I talk to you and you talk to me, we have viewpoints about each other, judgments, prejudices. And it's so exacerbated nowadays because of the use of, well, essentially propaganda. Now it's known as memes. These memes are pictures, headlines, information that all fits into our own individual narrative. And it's really natural for each of us to say with our own narrative and to think in terms of what only we believe. We want the world to be black and white. We want the world to be easy to understand. And when we stay within a group, they do that for us without us even realizing it. And this is how they corral us. This is how they put us into a herd and how they control us. Political campaigns use demographic information to determine how and what information to send to you in order to manipulate your behavior. The reason they do this, it's not necessarily malicious. It just makes good sense. Businesses do this as well. There's a whole documentary on Netflix. It's really great. I have to look up the name of it. And it goes into this. It was about the Cambridge Analytica scandal. And Cambridge Analytica actually used information. They used their understanding of psychology, which they used the ocean, Big Five personality traits, which are the most well-researched traits, which includes open-mindedness, extroversion, introversion, and I forget what the N, it basically means worrying, how much you worry or how positive you are. And so the Cambridge Analytica scandal actually revealed how they this company helped different political campaigns, including the Trump campaign, create. It's called the Great Hack. So how they created these campaigns using individual data and how they were able to exploit that information. And it's just the way the world is now. All of us are going to start using this information for dating, for political reasons, for business reasons. And it's up to us as individuals to understand how our privacy is affected and how we can protect ourselves. And I'll go into that in a bit on how I am using alternatives to Google and other apps in order to protect my information. So, let's go to a a noise. Just adding the noises in between to break the monotony. Like I was saying before, this on another podcast, I do want to have people calling in and call others. I don't want to just have it be me. But for now, let's talk about how this data collection is actually done. So data collection is, it's one of the most, I would say important, but it's one of the most valuable jobs at the moment. People's privacy is the only barrier. People's sense of privacy, understanding privacy is the only barrier to these companies collecting this data. And the data is then used to influence behavior, to understand behavior, to then go and promote certain actions, activities. In terms of companies like Google, they use it for engineering projects, the data. Sometimes it's just environmental and natural, but much of this data is about human beings, individuals' behavior, their biometrics, from the voice to their facial expressions, their body temperature, to the way they walk, to the gender, to all this objective data, which starts getting into this very creepy area. It's done by using geolocation data through apps like Lyft. Whenever you order a car, it knows where you are because of the fact it's tracking your data. And these companies like Lyft and Uber, they don't make any money. Their ultimate goal is to use this data and sell it to governments, to other companies, and ultimately show how people, where they go, what they do, and track individuals. And then use that data to more specifically target them with advertising and marketing and product and just all this consumer, all of this consumerism. So that is done through apps, through the phone tracking. Your phone has the capability of tracking your location at any given time. It has the ability to track a lot of biometric indicators. And here I have a article about, this is the headline, "Now your iPhone can read fingerprints." It's loading. "Now your iPhone can read fingerprints, scan irises, and ID your face." And if you've used Snapchat, you see how it uses that mask to cover your face. That's tracking your face. It's able to see your face. And when you go on Facebook, for instance, when it's able to instantly tag people, that capability is out there. And it can be quite frightening when you can be it randomly stopped recording right there, so I'm thinking that the government must be listening in. But I was just saying it can be quite frightening the way that this information can be tracked. And so, yeah, this biometric data, individual human beings' data at any given point. There's going to start being smart cities which have the ability to track how many people are in a given building, to how much that person would weigh, to all sorts of data being used by the government, by the buildings, by these people to make certain decisions. And whether or not that might be efficient or good for certain individuals, it really does go against our privacy to have that information completely exploited. Even if it's done in an anonymized way, there will be ways that people can exploit or use that information. If you don't want your identity tracked, for instance, you're going to have a tough time in the future where every single bit of data about you is being tracked, where algorithms and neural networks are being used to make connections through information and to understand how things work. And this goes into the idea of the society we live in as a surveillance society. In London, currently, there are how many CCTV cameras? Let's see. I think it was something like 400,000 CCTV cameras. And basically for every individual, for every 14 individuals in London, there is a camera, was the statistic. That is tracking you, that is able to see what you're doing and look at you. And it's similar to the way websites track us, apps track us. They can track us using clicks, site time, mouse movement, eye tracking, views. All of these things are used a lot of the time by small businesses or individuals just to provide a better product. But these larger companies, they have this capability and are using it for their own means. There's also apps that are able to find out your medical records, your financial information, legal records, all this information that you may not want to have out there. Snapchat's been hacked by other individuals, people that can see your intimate photos, who can see and learn anything they want to about you. Unless you really take it into your own hands and understand the way this is being done, people are going to use that information for their own purposes and sometimes to even influence or manipulate you. And if you're interested in sort of Cambridge Analytica's understanding of psychology and the basis of it, there's a great book, two great books by Robert Cialdini from ASU. One's called Persuasion, and the big, most popular one is called Influence. It goes into really basic human psychology, very interesting books. And so, there's specific examples of this being done, this exploitation of this information. There's Cambridge Analytica, for instance. Facebook was found giving information, user data to people, to businesses and to people. And now there's this Ring cameras that are coming out. They are, let's see. They're being used by law enforcement So if you own a Ring doorbell camera system, we've got bad news. The smart home company owned by Amazon, has been violating its customers' privacy in a pretty shocking way. Ring has highly privileged access to live customer camera feeds, utilizing its doorbells as well as in-home camera footage. All that's apparently required is a customer's email address. And so you can be spied on just by having your email, someone having your email. That's terrifying. People being able to look into you like a Big Brother house and look into your home, see what you're doing. Hackers, individuals. And this information can be used in manipulative and exploitative ways. And so there are some ways to protect yourself for sure. But the more connected we are, the more we start relying on technology to automatically help us to make our lives more convenient, the more we trade this ability away to actually protect our privacy. So I'm going to talk next about how massive this data is, how massive the collection of data is. So many of us have heard of or know about Google Translate, and it is a miracle technology. What we don't realize is that Google has been scanning and uploading information from so many different sources. We have the big producers of information throughout the world and science, and the information that they have can be instantly scanned by Google's technologies, no matter the language. And so I don't know the exact amount of information. Let's see. But for instance, in 2006, Google Translate came about, and it used statistical machine translation. This was based on a DARPA project and from 2003, which was able to translate information the quickest in a DARPA challenge. And then in 2016, they translated this into neural machine translation because, as we all know about Google Translate, often would have funny translations that didn't quite make sense. But now, using neural machine translation, it's able to more accurately predict information in a natural way. The use of AI to scan, analyze, and apply information is tremendous, and it's only going to get better. And so, in one instance, this is so beyond human capabilities. In May 2014, Google acquired WordLens to improve the quality of visual and voice translation. It is able to scan text or picture with one's device and have it translated instantly. Moreover, the system automatically identifies foreign languages and translates speech without requiring individuals to tap the mic button whenever speech translation is needed. And just think about how that applies not just to foreign languages, but to information in general. When you have information which can be instantly analyzed and translated, if AI or robots are being used to translate this information, they are going to be doing it in such a way that goes so beyond human capabilities. The fear then becomes that any sort of information can be exploited and hoarded by these companies for their own gain or for their own benefit. Deception becomes a organizational policy, and it becomes a power game to use information in specific ways. And while in certain cases it may be our obligation or our belief that businesses should be allowed to patent information or to use information to promote business interests, there does come a point where the good of humanity versus business interests comes to mind. If we had telephones, for instance, that only specific people could use in specific ways, and those phones were controlled by the government, let's say, there would be somewhat of an obligation for more people to have access to these cell phones. If you see how people with cell phones and telephones are able to contact people from all around the world, are able to have better economic, better life output, essentially. It's the difference between if we had tractors, but we made certain people use horses or donkeys, despite the fact that there's more than enough tractors to go around. It does become an issue when human beings are being intentionally suppressed. And you can see this in the car industry, for instance, when they had the EV1s, those electric vehicles, which were tremendously successful in their capabilities, and they were all destroyed. And nowadays, the car industry is starting to release vans and cars with going 80 miles to the gallon or 90 miles to the gallon. The new Toyota, I believe, was 96 miles per gallon. And that just proves to me, when it happens over a single year period, they were hiding this technology. It was a collective monopoly, all these companies that were preventing this technology from advancing. And that's the fear with companies owning this information, when they don't allow society progress because they hide or exploit the information for their own gains specifically. So there are some amazing things being done. And for instance, there's a project by DARPA called the Brain Initiative. And this project is trying to create a brain map using an understanding of action potentials between neurons and applying that information to create a brain map. And in this instance, that's a government project, but it's being funded by DARPA, which is a Defense and Research Project Agency, which is a military agency. If you go to their website, it's .mil. And the fear is that military or government interests are held above other interests. So information is being progressively analyzed, organized, and applied by large companies, organizations, and governments, each for their own purposes. While there are some, like Philip Rubin, who is actually working on the Brain Initiative, who work in the big government projects and advocate open communication of data, there are many, many people that are incentivized to exploit this information, to hoard and exploit it. And information can be used incorrectly by human users. In 2006, the TSA began to implement programs for identifying terrorists and then acting on that information. These human operators were trained on 94 objective criteria on how to pre-screen individuals. Currently, critics of the program argue that it does target minorities, that's ineffective at preventing crime. And this is still ongoing. This is called the SPOT program. Still ongoing. And if autonomous operators or artificial intelligence was programmed with the same biases as human beings, how much more efficient at this, and thus worse, would these situations be? And will it get to the point where every job can conceivably be done better by a robotic servant? So you have a AI that analyzes a person's face using these criteria, it says they're a terrorist, and then you have a robot tackle them, causing them harm or injury, and or just causing them shame and humiliation. And it's an everyday struggle for people in minority groups to have their dignity upheld, because they're put in these very awkward, uncomfortable situations constantly. And I don't envy them. I'm a white man, so I get uncomfortable having to take my belt off and having to take my shoes off and all that at the TSA line. And I can't imagine how awkward and uncomfortable that is to know that you're more likely, I think they said 80% more likely to be chosen in a line. And so now I'm going to get to the way that data can be protected. So I'm currently using an alternative to Google. I work for a subsidiary of Google, and I don't trust Google as far as I can throw it. DuckDuckGo.com. It doesn't track your data, and it is about just as good. Sometimes I go on Google to actually use location services and get directions and whatnot, but or look what's nearby, but mostly DuckDuckGo has what I'm looking for. I find that I can research things, I can find multiple sources, and they're just as good if not as specific or exact as Google's. I just don't want them knowing every single thing about me, and then using that information to create ads. And then all of their free products, like Gmail as well, they're reading our emails. And there's actually a Medium article, it's really great. It's basically, let me see if I can find the title of it, How to Stop Using Google. How I fully quit Google and you can too. It's a great article about how this guy and he admits that he still does use Google for some applications. His name is Nathan Coca, And I'm sorry if I say that wrong, but it's a money. This is what he says in the article. Google turned from a company releasing useful products to one that has ensnared us and the internet as a whole into its money-making, data-gathering apparatus. Google's pervasive in our digital lives and in a way no other corporation is or ever has been. With Apple, you're either in the I world or out. Same with Amazon, and Facebook owns only a few platforms, but quitting is more of a psychological challenge, and it's actually difficult. Than actually difficult. So basically, this guy goes into how you can stop using your email for Google. And yes, it's going to make your life slightly more inconvenient in certain ways, but in other ways, it really doesn't matter. He gives an alternative to Chrome. There's the Brave app, which I know a lot of people use. Hangouts alternative, he said, Jitsi Meet, never heard of it. Zoom is also popular among business professionals. Google Maps, use Here We Go instead. And it's some that are a lot better, but they're paid for, but they don't track you. This one's called Proton Mail. Proton Mail, what appealed to this guy, he says, what really appealed to me about Proton Mail is that unlike other privacy-minded email programs, it was user-friendly. The interface is similar to Gmail, and you don't need to know anything about security or privacy to use it. Free version gives you 500 megabytes of storage space, and then this guy opted for the paid 5 gigabytes that comes along with their VPN service. So I don't know how much that is, but essentially everything that you use through Google can be used in other by other people, either a free version or a paid for version, which how much is your privacy worth to you? How much is being exploited by these companies worth to you? If you find that you really don't mind, then don't worry about it in any way. But if you think about it and it really bothers you that these companies are exploiting your information, consider using alternatives. So the title of the article once again is How I Quit Google and You Can Too by Nitin Koka. And then the last part of this podcast, we're going to talk about the Challenger explosion. And it comes to a really sad end that data, or the misunderstanding, the misapplication of data, led to tragedy. So, not a lot of people may know the actual cause of the explosion, the Challenger explosion. Some people might not even know what the Challenger explosion is. So let's look up an article. So the Challenger explosion, basically, there was a teacher, and it was really a teacher that won some sort of, it's like a fifth grade teacher who won a child like a competition or won some sort of lottery or something, and she was gonna be the first woman in space. And her students would have been watching. People would have been very excited about this explosion. I mean, about this, not the explosion, but about the launch. And so, five NASA astronauts, one payload specialist, and a civilian school teacher. On January 28th, 1986, the NASA Space Shuttle Orbiter undertaking mission STS-51L and the 10th flight of Space Shuttle Challenger broke apart 73 seconds into its flight. The disintegration of the vehicle began after a joint in its right solid rocket booster failed at liftoff. The failure was caused by the failure of O-ring seals used in the joint that were not designed to handle the unusually cold conditions that existed at this launch. This was a tragedy, but in the aftermath, and actually trying to understand what happened, they realized that these O-rings were the cause. And you would think of NASA as being very, very accurate. Actually, during this time, they had a saying, saying, "In God we trust, but to all others bring data." And so they understood the use of data, understood why it was important to have data to make decisions. But what happened is that on this specific day, January 28th, 1986, it was a very cold day. And what happened is that they had the information about the rocket flight.
Investigators found that a compressed O-ring is 5 times more responsive at 75 degrees Fahrenheit than at 30 degrees Fahrenheit. O-ring resiliency is directly related to its temperature. A warm O-ring will follow the opening of the tank to cleave a gap, which is important. It goes in between the two sections of the solid rocket motor, which are the tang and the clevis. And a cold O-ring may not. It may not follow that opening. And that's what the report found afterwards. The engineers... the question does arise then, why did the engineers not stop the launch? But in fact, they did try. So they were concerned that the temperature was going to be lower than 50 or 53 that they had ever flown, which was the previous January, and they had experienced some erosion earlier. It wasn't a major concern. This is what the guys say. It wasn't a major concern, but we said, gee, you know, we just didn't know how much further we can go below the 51 or 53 degrees or whatever it was, so we're concerned with the unknowns. They didn't have enough data. And when they looked at the data, they tried to present it to their superior. They looked at the data, and the team recognized they didn't have data below 53 degrees. They decided to look at all cases where there had been signs of O-ring distress, regardless of temperature. And so there was stress at 75 degrees, at 70 degrees, and at 63 degrees. And on 7 separate missions, there's evidence of O-ring thermal stress. However, when they looked at all the data, all the incidents, above 65 degrees, only 3 out of 20 flights had incidents. And below 65 degrees, all 4 flights had incidents. And they were looking at the wrong... they didn't have the data presented in the right way. And there's no way to know until afterwards they had made this mistake. And so all they had really were these photographs. They're trying to present this information based on these photographs where they saw that during the test flight, these O-rings weren't being responsive, and based on this other information in the previous flights. And there wasn't evidence of failure, but there was evidence, there was not absence of evidence, or there wasn't evidence of absence. And so because this was such a big launch, because it was so important, so famous, they decided to go ahead anyways, and that would have been the tragedy that occurred. It was using data in a way to create a narrative or to allow something that we wanted to happen anyways. And that is the story of our future. Who owns the data and what do they want? What incentives do they have? Are they going to go ahead and do what they want until we have another Challenger explosion? All right, Joy Scouts, go out there and learn and use this information to better yourself. Be prepared for joy.